The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buppert, retired army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 59 of Chasing Ghost, an Irregular Warfare podcast. The subject of this one will be the Mexican Cartel Conundrum, War Without End, Part 2. I decided to continue on with the last conversation we had here on this podcast concerning the potential kinetic war against the cartels, and by extension, the Mexican government, or wherever this bleeds off into all the way down to Tierra del Fuego in South America, the entirety of Latin America, and what this is going to entail. A little bit of housekeeping. As always, I wanted to thank all of my listeners for tuning in. I wanted to thank you for reviews that you leave, stars that you leave on your podcast vendor. And please be sure to mention to friends, family, and colleagues who may be interested in listening to my bloviations here at the podcast. As part of the housekeeping, I wanted to review very quickly in the companion podcast, War Notes, a Conflict podcast. Episode 13 was entitled End of an Era, the Infantry Folds Its Colors. One of my correspondents, a longtime and perennial correspondent, CG, we've continued to have a really interesting conversation about this. And one thing that I wanted to highlight is something that he mentioned that I think is so vital to that entire conversation. I made a passing mention of camouflage as being an anachronism when it comes to visual indicators and such, and the centuries, if not millennia old notion of not only conformity, uniformity, and having camouflage on opposing forces, no matter how many there may be in a given conflict, that camouflage uniforms, whether monotoned or multicolored, whatever the case may be, have been critically important. And one thing that I may not have emphasized correctly is that it's not as important as we found before from a tactical perspective, maybe from a uniformity perspective as far as esprit de corps, knowing what side you're on, visual cues, and that kind of thing. But remember, in this era now, we are talking about visual cues not being the entirety of the fight that we're going to be in. The electromagnetic spectrum and the entirety of what is transmitted and received on future battlefields for the remainder of this century, if not well into the future, but hell if I know what warfare is going to look like after 2100 AD. But CG brings up something in recent correspondence, which I think bears repeating here. And remember, this references episode 13 concerning the infantry in the companion podcast, War Notes. He says, quote, "For example, you brought up camouflage, and you're absolutely right. Any emissions will get you killed. From what I can tell, the military is doubling down on putting more emissions devices on the individual, like radios, Garmin watches, and attack cellular devices. When I explain that any emissions will be targeted with fires in a matter of minutes, if not seconds, as we progress forward, the retort is always, yeah, but it's encrypted. Every soldier becomes a little Blue Force tracker, and now every vehicle and soldier is a beacon begging to get targeted. They can't even conceptualize the problem, let alone counter or tackle it. They will be fed into the meat grinder before they can even understand what happened, probably before they make it to the forward line of troops, riding in their trucks, vehicles, or aircraft," end of quote. I think that's very telling. I think that that's an illumination that everybody needs to bury in their brain pan right now, because that is one of the features of the future of warfare. Thanks, CG. So on to the present episode, let's rock. So what's really interesting that I talked about in the first episode concerning this kinetic fight or war that the current administration wants to bring to the cartels because of what the cartels are doing with drugs and human trafficking over the contiguous border between the United States and Mexico, and what that would portend. It is my suggestion that if we look at this from a deeply analytical perspective, what we discover is that when we try to measure out the second and third order effects of what's going to happen, I made a few observations, among which was, if you go to war with the drug cartels in Mexico, you are going to war with the Mexican government. Number two, if you go to war with the cartels and stretch them down, as I mentioned previously in the prelude to this, all the way out, down to Tierra del Fuego at the tip of Latin America, you will find that when you engage cartels within respective countries, you are engaging in wars with those countries because of the contamination and cross-leveling, cross-germination between the existence of very large and profitable criminal cartels, like what has been talked about here, and their relationships with the governments that either look the other way, actively engage with them, or maybe even help them along in their supply chain. Remember, this is supply chain meeting a massive demand signal in the US and Europe. And there's another very dark aspect of this, which with the analytical rigor that I like to apply to this kind of thing, I can't find a lot of sourcing material for this for obvious reasons, but there has been much speculation of three-letter agencies in the U.S. and the West being involved in drug trafficking. For instance, we know for a fact and a legal stipulation that in the 1980s, there was an attempt via the CIA to use monies it would use from drug profits to fund what it was doing in Nicaragua to fight against the Nicaraguan communists. Time and again, as we've discovered, for instance, with some of the U.S. Agency for International Development revelations, we discovered that a significant amount of money has been spent on convincing the Taliban to reactivate poppy fields, or before the Taliban took over and during the 20 years that America was in there spinning its wheels in Afghanistan, that there were some very odd circumstances when it came to the incentives that were provided for growing poppy to feed the heroin addiction planet-wide, from whence Afghanistan provided a significant amount of said core products for developing the heroin in the first place. We had also examined what I suppose would be, if you bring your best shooters, your best assaulters, your tier one assets, your carnivores from Delta CAG, from STS 20, Special Tactics Squadron 24, from SEAL Team 6, again, when they're not on a publishing or a book tour or a speaking tour, and you bring all of these really elite elements that America has honed to a very fine edge into this fight, what you will discover is that the blowback, the second and third order effects, the kind of returns on this particularly unsound investment that will resonate within not only the country of Mexico, which you will be waging war on, whether you acknowledge that or not, but also across the very sophisticated, deep, and wide logistics, warehousing, and distribution networks that have been used not only for getting drugs to every burg in America that tweaks that demand signal, but also the human trafficking that has become a secondary market to the cartels, and which they become very expert at in establishing these rat lines and these highway arterials to get people in undercover, covertly, clandestinely, because they don't want to go through the formal process of entering the country legally. Hence, they have become quite adept at doing that thing and bringing in OTMs other than Mexicans. And as I have alluded to in my Storming America podcast series, in which I talked about what an upsized and upscaled Gaza-type attack from October 7th, 2023 on Israel would look like here in America, this would be one of the forcing functions, the factors that allows that to become reality. I'd also mentioned that what happens if in the war between Russia and Ukraine, in which we find two transmission networks of illicit weapons planet-wide from Ukraine proper, maybe even from Russia, maybe from other BRICS countries, that would be twofold in this respect. All of the weapon systems, whether exquisite or the small arms or the ATGMs or the missiles of every type and stripe, and the monies that have gone over there, not all of that money that has actually found its way on the ground in Ukraine stays there. So there may be some kind of cartel acquisition policy if this invasion of Mexico and the cartels were to happen kinetically, per the administration's present wishes, that they would find their way into Mexico proper. All of these weapons, all of these monies. The second, and what I find to be increasingly smaller likelihood, is Russia saying, you know, all is fair in love and war. So since you provided all of these small arms and exquisite weapon systems and everything in between to the Ukraine, if you were to go to war with Mexico, why wouldn't Russia or other malefactors in this case consider supplying the Mexican cartels, and by extension, it would get to the Mexican government, the means by which they would have these sophisticated weapon systems to deploy against either the Tier 1 forces or, inevitably, the American military forces that would be used to invade Mexico proper. Now, this seems alarming. I realize that, but follow me here. Here's the logic. Once you go to kinetically take out the cartels, once you try to do it in a surgical fashion, the cartels will respond in a very violent way along the contiguous border, using their very sophisticated and deep black networks in the United States to get shooters, assets, IEDs, and all of those things to attack agents, police, family members of all of the above, to attack infrastructure, to fund terrorist organizations, to conduct what they may find common cause with. For instance, I've often said that the probability, not the possibility, but the probability of having Islamist terror cells rise up one Tuesday morning and start a day or two or three of mayhem across the fruited plain is even more likely if this kinetic war against the drug cartels were to be authorized by the present administration. Now, I do think when I was talking about the Russian possibility of bringing weapon systems and such, that the dressing down that Zelensky just got from the administration during his visit to the Oval Office may, I wouldn't say force the hand, but at least guide the hand of Russia and maybe being a little more resistant to bringing sophisticated weapon systems and supplying them to Mexico or the cartels. Now, I tend to be data-driven and evidence-bound in my analytics and trying to come to the single most accurate picture of what the hell is going on now and what the hell may be going on in the future. When you look at the drug trade around the world, we're not talking about human trafficking. We're simply talking about the drug trade. You're talking about a market that is approximately $500 billion. But the problem set that we have in determining that data, of course, is that a lot of those costs and profits are hidden because this is an underground black market. And are we talking about profits at the retail level, at the wholesale level, whatever the case may be? Because remember, one can reliably say that when it comes to the wholesale trade, the actual, for instance, when it comes to developing coca for cocaine out of Peru or Colombia or Mexico and such, it's dirt cheap, but they're able to mark these things up at 3 to 10 times the price for the final product that finds it on the street to meet the demand signal in the US and Europe. In the end, if one is addressing the demand signal, that reception, receipt, and purchase of said product at the retail level is where the rubber hits the road as far as the markets. But it's not the rubber, it's not where the rubber hits the road for supply. But in the end, if you don't retard or cut back on the demand signal, you will have people stepping in at the wholesale and retail levels, no matter how many of them you take out, in order to meet the supply demand in the US and Europe. Look, and here's something that Western countries, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, have to come to Jesus with, and that's this. There's a concept in economics called inelastic and elastic. Elastic means that if the price of something starts to increase or decrease, there is not a lot of customer loyalty to whatever that may be. This could be toilet paper. This could be a box of paper towels or whatever the case may be. Inelasticity tends to be a little more esoteric and a little more exotic. For instance, the market for Rolls-Royces, Ferraris, Lamborghinis will always be there no matter what price is asked. The same thing applies here. In study after study, when they've looked at the demand signal for the consumption of drugs, they found that when prices go up at the retail level for said drugs, the users find a way to meet that. One can look at what's happening with the quasi-legalized heroin industry in the UK and the Netherlands, and you find that this very thing holds. And I want everybody to divorce yourself from the 20th century concepts of the drug trade, because now with the synthetic drug industry potentially overwhelming the environmental factors and the country-specific agricultural parameters that inform drug trades such as heroin, such as marijuana, things like that, all of that is changing in a very radical and rapid fashion as we speak. And what we'll find is that when you levy your forces against a country in which the cartel happens to be operating, in this case, Mexico, which remember with the heroin trade, for instance, it moved from Peru to Colombia, back to Peru, and found itself in other areas. But most of those governments found themselves compromised in one way or another. What I'd like to say is that if the U.S., for instance, says that, okay, it's a kinetic war against Mexico, they press the green button, and that very thing happens, this is not going to end well. And not only that, it's not going to stop the drugs from being manufactured. I just mentioned synthetic drugs. I think that when you look at the democratization of 3D printing, for instance, and what that's done to gun control, because gun control is dead as a result of the global capability to, for the most part, build firearms in your home with very sophisticated software programs, and all of the intuition engines and engineering capabilities that are harnessed at the atomistic level that allow literally tens of thousands of rifle and pistol designs to be abundant wherever you may find them, whether it's on the dark web, the internet, you exchange a hard drive with somebody that has the plans, you plug it into your 3D printing machine, voila, you can make whatever you wish. The same thing is going to be here for the remainder of this century when it comes to the synthetic development of drugs that will be absolutely agnostic to the location of environmental conditions, a la Peru or Colombia, where because of growing conditions, that's the only place they can grow them, so that's the only place to be hit. Because what's going to happen for the remainder of this century, and I've emphasized this when it comes to the revolutions in military affairs, is that when it comes to the production of drugs to meet the tremendous demand signal in the West, it will become more and more synthetic, not only in delivery means, but in manufacturing means of the very drugs that used to grow out of the ground and the earth. You've got to keep in mind that cartels play a role more like that of large supermarkets. They buy produce from farmers, processing it and packaging it, then selling it to consumers from the wholesale to the retail level, sort of farm to table, but when it comes to drugs. And then you also learn that the straightforward ineptitude is frequently the cause of drug traffickers' downfall. We all complain incessantly, as I think is more than justified, about the Keystone Cops attitudinally when it comes to all police prosecution of the drug war since Nixon's creation of the DEA in 1972. Of course, the drug war is being prosecuted on a more informal basis before that time. As a matter of fact, since the end of Prohibition in 1933, where all those Treasury officials needed something to do after they were taken off alcohol and they started pursuing other things like marijuana production in the 1930s. So yes, I am all aboard with the absolute galactic ineptitude of all of the drug war efforts above ground and below ground to a certain extent, of all the three-letter agencies at the federal level all around, all the way down to the local level and everything in between. But you have to realize on the other side of the curtain where you have the actual drug trade and those practitioners, they live soap opera lifestyles of the dealers and their associates that were often what caused them to get caught. In one case that I read about, a courier who had to hand over $500,000 in cash decided to put the bills on a bed and have sex with his 17-year-old girlfriend, taking selfies while doing so. When the girlfriend showed the pics to the driver's wife, the wife became so enraged that she tipped off the police about him. These things happen all the time, tens of thousands of incidents like this. So I don't want anybody to think that I have this conception of the cartels as being these not vainglorious creatures of maximum aptitude and competency who are able to outwit the police and the law enforcement agencies at every turn, because this is a play between two complex adaptive systems, the drug trade at the wholesale and retail level on the one side, and those in the government and other organizations who are seeking to tackle the problem on the other side. It turns into a chaos avalanche. It turns into a cavalcade of calamities whenever these entities collide, and there is some humor in it, and then again, for most of it, it is simply tragedy. So all of us know what a monopoly is. A monopoly is erecting legal barriers to competition so that one has the sole provisioning of said market. That turns a little bit differently when it comes to underground and black markets, which are more rife with violence than the above ground markets that assume monopolies. But I want you guys to embrace another word, which is called a monopsony. A monopsony is a market structure where a single buyer has significant control over the market. Now, I would urge you to think that monopsony in the above ground market would be the American and European provisioning of defense and offense capabilities when it comes to war making and the military. In this case, what you would find is you would find that there are dominant players as a result, for the most part, of not only their violence and willingness to do so, but the sophistication of their delivery networks, as I've described before. Look, destroying crops doesn't raise the prices that wholesale farmers charge to cartels, because the armed groups that control the cocaine trade in Colombia, for instance, act as these monopsonies that I just described. That means that one group has a monopoly in specific regions like cable companies in Trinidad and Tobago until recently. All that destroying crops does is make poor farmers poorer, while the cartel's profits remain the same because they're the ones who absorb the costs at the lower level. The farmers, not the cartels. From coca leaf to cocaine powder, the markup is more than 30,000%. Put another way, even if destroying crops tripled the farmers' prices, the retail price in the United States would rise less than 1%. And, you know, this doesn't seem like a good return on the billions of dollars invested in disrupting the supply of leaves in the Andes. I want to quote from a book called Narconomics, How to Run a Drug Cartel by Tom Wainwright. This is during the Nixon era. Quote, a few months after coining the phrase war on drugs, Richard Nixon was in the Oval Office discussing a government-designed anti-drugs brochure with his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman. Nixon was furious. They put in as a quote from the president on the front of the pamphlet with a picture and a good strong picture in the rest that said that the problem of drugs is our number one and must be dealt with in a variety of ways, Nixon fumed. When I saw a variety of ways, I goddamn near puked. And I thought, for pity's sake, we need all-out war on all fronts or despicable. Haldeman agreed. Handle it in a variety of ways really says we don't know how to handle it, he told the president, which may be the truth, but it sure as hell isn't the thing to say. End of quote. He goes on. This has been the approach of most governments ever since. Unsure how to handle the world's growing addiction to drugs, they have resolutely stuck to the unsuccessful policies already in place. With every passing year, the result becomes plainer to see. The all-out war approach has failed to cut the number of consumers, while it has driven up the price of a few cheap agricultural commodities to create a hideously violent, multi-billion-dollar-a-year global industry, end of quote. Now, look, I'm an Austrian economist by trade, so you can go to the von Mises Institute, and you can go to the execrable Cato Institute. You can even go to my very own Libertarian Institute, at which I am a fellow, and you will find again and again that there are plenty of detailed articles with footnotes and citations detailing how to tackle this problem, how to decriminalize, how to legalize, how to do all of those things. So what I'm telling all the folks who are listening as we speak is that if you want the economic basis for why, there are reams of information available to you there. To stay within the scope of my podcast, Chasing Ghost, in which we tackle irregular warfare and everything in between, in this case, this would be gray zone warfare, hybrid warfare, information warfare, information shaping warfare, propaganda both black and white, and all the rest. But also what we're tackling here is a possible military option. So since I published the last podcast episode on the drug war and a possible kinetic war by this administration, by the way, it may have been pursued by a previous administration. I really do think that regardless of the party in power, since it was formalized in 1972 with the formation of the DEA and Nixon's war on drugs, this has been a continuing and persistent motif among American presidencies to tackle this very problem, and none of them have tackled it. Now, have some of them tried to take kinetic means where they send in teams to decapitate cartels and decapitate major players in the drug industry and such? It certainly has happened to no effect. You can see what's happened with the DEA and the three-letter agencies and probably other Western agencies from Europe or maybe even across the Pacific where they're dealing with the triads and what those countries have done to tackle their various drug demand problems that they have in their own respective countries. We can't point to any one of them in which military kinetics solve the problem. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I'm here to tell you that if we conduct this kinetic campaign, if by extension we find ourselves declaring war on Mexico or a host of other Latin American countries, and then we engage in full-scale conflict, which in this case will involve a guerrilla war, America and its allies in Europe especially have shown a very solid penchant for losing these and ending in defeat or stalemate. After thousands of lives are expended, thousands of lives are ruined through wounding and maiming, and of course, trillions of dollars are spent to tilt at the windmill and go after this problem set. But here's what makes these particular circumstances very unique. So I bang the drum on and on about the revolutions and military affairs that the military complexes in the West are facing now and for the remainder of this century. This is going to be a new wrinkle in military campaigns in which America has shown itself to be decisively incapable of conducting counterinsurgency, of conducting effective counter-guerrilla campaigns, even guerrilla campaigns. And that because of that, here we find ourselves on the brink of doing it yet again. How effective will it be? Well, let's suppose we're going to suspend our disbelief and believe that the kinetic campaign across the Mexican border will be wildly successful, will confine itself to the Mexican border, and that they'll be able to surgically remove and decapitate all of the cartel leaders and networks to such an extent that all the folks involved in this nearly trillion-dollar industry planet-wide throw up their hands and say, man, these kinetic operations and surgical strikes and the decapitation of our leaders and financiers and auxiliaries in this organization are going to make it so that we can't do this profitably. So I think we're going to close up shop and stop. That's never going to happen. They will find a way. To paraphrase Jeff Goldblum's brilliant character in the first Jurassic Park, nature will find a way. In this case, the drug trade, the human trafficking trade will find a way because the demand signal is so high. Now, what I just posed to you is completely imbecilic and dreamlike because that's not the way it's going to play out. Here's the way it's going to play out. If this kinetic war, if this declaration of war on Mexico, which is what it will be, whether Americans like it or not, happens, there will be severe repercussions that will leverage and use and exploit the tremendously deep and wide network of logistics facilities and retail facilities and wholesaling warehouses and everything across America in a very hyper-violent and savvy fashion. Not only will there be violence against military elements domestically for the first time since brief border clashes with the Mexican army or irregulars at the beginning of the 20th century, but it will be the first time maybe since that August 24th day in 1814 when the White House was burned down by the British, where you actually find military conflict occurring on United States soil as a result of this ill-advised and ill-informed initiative to take the war to the cartels. Imagine, if you will, as I talked about in the previous episode, what's going to happen if all of a sudden the human trafficking networks that brought in all the OTMs, the other than Mexicans, who have had a very lucrative and long relationship with Middle Eastern malefactors who wanted to get sleeper cells or their folks in here. And by the way, these sleeper cells aren't only Islamist fanatics with weapons who will clack off on a given Tuesday, as I have made mention of, and do all kinds of horrific damage to the United States, killing thousands of Americans and possibly maiming and mauling hundreds of thousands more, whatever that death toll may look like. But there's going to be the quieter experts who will be out there wrecking infrastructure, maybe even using the internet internally to shape narratives in a fashion that is not a positive spin for America trying to win the propaganda war, both white and black in the United States. What's going to happen when they take the hundreds of thousands of students at universities across the nation who have been the sine qua non, the fulcrum upon which all the narrative shaping against Israel or for the Palestinians, however you wish to look at that, I am agnostic to that fight, because when it comes to the Israelis and the Palestinians, I consider it their fight, and I certainly don't want to bring it here. What's going to happen if the traffickers, the cartels, the malefactors, and all the folks who find themselves south of the border, and by the way, when you say south of the border, you also mean north of the border, because when it comes to cartel leverage and influence, they have probably tens of thousands of folks in their direct employ in North America proper above the Mexican border, who will be given their marching orders. Well, what's going to happen with all of these students who provide for a very ready auxiliary force to clog up 911 lines, to take to the streets, to block arterials, to stand outside of police stations, to file lawsuits against said police stations or police forces from the local to the federal level, as a result of all the kinetic engagements that will start occurring after that time and clogging up the entire judicial system? All of these things are likely outcomes of kinetic hits on the cartels. I'm hoping that this administration, and not blaming them, I'm not singling them out, because I think that every administration has suffered from this, where they stand athwart history, put their hands on their hips in the first 90 days they're in office, and they say, we're going to make the war on drugs work, and we will declare victory because we've got what it takes to deploy the recipes that are going to make us fix the fight and win the fight. It ain't going to happen. This fight will not end well. For those of you who are persistent listeners to both of my podcast series, you will know that I have a very dim view of the military capabilities of the United States and the West in both the conventional and the unconventional realm, in that when you look at what's going to be happening here is that for the first time, we are going to be witnessing not only this fight in CONUS, if this war is initiated, but it will lay bare all of the inadequacies and incompetence of the DOD and connecting them to all the police functions and agencies. Remember, there's 19,000 police departments from the local to the federal level. The Keystone Cops theatrics that will occur as a result of this will be a sight to see. I'm reading a book by Christopher Gotcha called The Road to Dien Bien Phu, which was the fight in 1954 that saw the French driven out of Indochina after an abortive 9-year war. What is really unique about that particular conflict in the 20th century is that the Vietnamese were able to meld seamlessly and successfully all of their guerrilla elements with their conventional forces in a way that no other country has successfully used to send invaders, in this case, both French and U.S., and by the 1970s, the Chinese, fleeing out of their country after stalemate and defeat. We may see the 21st century variant of this, because is there a possibility that conventional formations will be leveraged and employed by Mexico at the border to fight the United States proper? I don't think so. But what I think is going to be very interesting here is that not only will you see guerrilla fighting, because that's what the characterization is going to be, is guerrilla and insurgency by definitional constructs, but you're going to see them besting conventional formations if arrayed against them simply through the use of robotics in quantity, simply by the use of UAVs, FPVs, first-person vehicle drones, things like that. Those will be deployed by the cartels because they have deep pockets. You're kidding yourself if you don't think that the cartels are very savvy right now, right here, about drone technology, what it can do for them, not simply from a weapons perspective, but also from the perspective of using them for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, ISR, which is a vital military skills adjunct of conventional forces and unconventional forces alike. They will employ these kind of things. For instance, what would happen if the cartels say, okay, two can play at this game? What happens if the cartels do an infrastructure analysis, or they have access to the infrastructure analyses that have been done by the Congress, for instance, when they were talking about the vulnerability of the U.S. power infrastructure, I think it was from 2008 to 2010, to EMP, to coronal mass ejection events, which is called a CME. It's a solar event where solar flares fry electronics after they burn through the atmosphere to reach transistorized systems and fry them to such an extent that they are unrecoverable unless they are replaced in total. What happens if the cartels decide to say, you know what we're going to do? We're going to leverage the capabilities, which are lesser than that of U.S. military conventional and unconventional forces, and we're going to strike things that are rather mundane, some would even say banal or invisible. So if in response to this campaign, what if no cartel or Mexican government entity struck back in a kinetic fashion against the American military, against American political forces or police forces or anything like that, but decided that the response was to get people to the negotiating table by striking infrastructure? Here's what that may look like. We're going to go down a rather mundane list of infrastructure vulnerabilities. We have water. So what happens if all manhole covers are somehow removed? What about drinking fountains and those are sabotaged with chemical or biological weapons? What happens with waste management if all of a sudden the entire waste management infrastructure is struck in a fashion in which they find a way to electronically downgrade the entire local or county or state grid that sends garbage trucks on their way every day and coordinates all of the exquisite choreography and ballet that goes into picking up the garbage on a weekly basis or a monthly basis? What about subsurface cisterns, those places in a lot of states where you have these vast bodies of water that no one can see that are subject to intrusion and the despoiling thereof? What happens, and here in Florida, we're very acquainted with this because of hurricanes, what happens if there is a serial downing of utility poles? What happens if those power grids are struck in some fashion? What happens when streetlights simply go out at the wrong time, which happens to be the right time for those who wish them to go out? What's going to happen, for instance, with internet cables and the provision of the internet to people's homes if somehow the cartels find out where the nodes are that tentacle out to all the millions of homes and find a way to disrupt or destroy those? With roadways, what happens if, as a demonstration project, an entire city's traffic lights, all of the electronic means of making arterial traffic coordinate itself to such an extent that cars can actually move, what's going to happen if somehow that system is interfered with? And this has two implications. The first implication is that they do this in a single city and they say that, well, you know what? We can do this anywhere we wish. And if you keep on screwing around with our business, we will expand our activities to include other cities, entire counties, possibly even entire states. There are so many hidden aspects to everyday life that they could hit that are absolutely unguarded, unprotected, and eminently vulnerable to these kind of strikes. So the suggestion that I would make to policymakers is that you have to take all of this into account if you decide to start yet another war. In this case, the protestations have been about starting a kinetic war, a war actual, where you actually take lives. In this case, decapitation of cartel leaders, the messing around of cartel networks, maybe lower level killings. I mean, there's been all this courageous and stunning and brave talk about sending our finest shooters and assaulters from the tier one organizations down there to put the fear of God or gods into the cartels. And I just think to myself, I don't think that they have 10th manned or steel manned these arguments out to look at what the Pandora's box is that will be opened if they were to start this kind of thing. The bottom line for me is that I hold out no hope that if a war is started against the cartels, which means a war against Mexico in this case, or maybe it's going to be a rolling cascade of waging war on wherever the cartels find themselves. Let's isolate ourselves to Latin America to make it simpler. Along that entire axis, all the way down to the southern tip of South America, and what that will entail and whether we even have the means to do so. Fortunately, those of you who have listened to my Fixing Fight Club series on War Notes know the precarious and absolute egregious state of nature that is America's military from A to Z, and how I would suppose that from a conventional fashion, even against fourth world players like the Mexican military, we are still going to suffer significant casualties, both killed and wounded. And we are going to suffer in any war that America goes into, a hot war that it goes into in this century. When it comes to exquisite platforms, everything from carriers and larger ships all the way down to infantry fighting vehicles and tanks and such, those will be targeted in a fashion in which the salvo competition is they will take $50,000 to $100,000 modalities, UAS, UAVs, IEDs, bombs, whatever the case may be, and use those to destroy multi-million dollar vehicles and platforms. And after a while, manufacturing won't be able to keep up with replacing not only the holes, but also the people that were killed in said vehicles. Most of my listeners know that it is outside of the scope for me to offer the solution to the demand signal in the United States, but I do think that experimentation with legalization and decriminalization may be in order in parallel to whatever it is that they want to do to take on the cartels. But this idea of a military conflict is simply not going to end well, and you heard it here. I mean, you don't have to be an expert military analyst or even have the tradecraft or the historical knowledge to know that any kinetic war going after the cartels simply isn't going to end well. I would try to take a step back and look into history and find ways in which this has ended well. And what you find, for instance, is that there's very few ways in which you stop drug running. Some of the most horrific penalties for drug running happen to be in Saudi Arabia and Singapore, yet they still have a demand signal that is met. The United States does have an opportunity with 50 states to have 50 different laboratories to find the very best way to tackle this demand signal and the use of drugs or abuse of drugs in America without resorting to what they've talked about. I know for a lot of people in a reactionary fashion, it sounds bold and heroic to say, well, we're going to take the war to the cartels. We've been taking the war to the cartels officially, as I mentioned, since 1972, and it has ended badly across the board. Remember, we had the Colombians fighting the communist FARC, which used drugs to finance its lifeblood of rebellion. It used also hostage taking and human trafficking and a variety of other things. I just think that they need to find some more creative ways to meet this, because if you simply make this a supply side war and not a demand side conflict, then inevitably you will find queues and queues and hundreds, if not thousands, of folks who will be willing to step up to even stand in the warm blood puddle of the leader or cartel member who has just been put to rest as a result of the war America wants to wage. That's not going to stop. They will keep stepping up, because the profits in what is approaching $1 trillion a year business, that siren song is very powerful, and it will attract, especially in the underground economy, the black market economy, the very worst kind of people who are willing to do the very worst kind of things, to meet the very worst people doing the very worst kind of things with the worst kind of behavior that we would employ in kinetic campaigns. Remember, I'm the one who has scolded those of you who think torture is an effective way to do their business, that if you look at Exhibit A, which is the French use of torture in Indochina and Algeria, you can even look at the U.S. use of torture in the Philippines at the end of the 19th century and the turn of the 20th century. And I am convinced that moral injury occurs, and that not only does it corrupt and corrode the soul of the tortured in such a vicious and murderous way, but the torturer themselves, especially when it becomes a torture industrial complex, as we saw with the war on terror at the beginning of the 21st century, it corrupts everything that it touches. And I'm hoping that we don't start to engage in that very kind of thing that makes us numb to the moral injury we all know is lurking out there. Let me paint a very grim picture for you. They activate one of our esteemed, august, and very capable assaulter units in CAG, what was once known as Delta, a Tier 1 organization. And they send them down in, let's say, company strength. You know what we're going to do? We're going to make the math easy. We're going to say they send down 24 shooters from a squadron that go down there, and they've got the very best tips, target intelligence packets, the very best electronic means, and even drones employed to get PID and CID on their targets. PID is positive identification. CID is combat identification. In this case, the legals will tell them they'll need positive identification, which means that once they have them scoped and in sight, and once they have the building and trained, and once they're just about to drop onto the roof, because if you have a multi-story building, you never assault from the bottom, you always assault from the top because of stairwell problems, and they're ready to go, and they get the green light, and they go in there, and they just so happen to know that this is cartel headquarters for Sinaloa Inc., or you can fill in the blanks with whatever you want to call it. They manage to kill 10 top members of that cartel. There is some collateral damage, because it just so happens that some of the cartel leaders' families were in there, and they just so happened to be gunned down or grenaded or whatever the case may be. So there were civilian casualties. The extraction didn't go quite as well as they thought it would, and there were a few casualties for CAG, wounded, not killed, and they return. There's something that you have to realize about military bases, and in this case, where CAG is located, and it's located in a number of places, but we do know for certain that some of it is located at Fort Bragg, formerly known as Fort Liberty, but they just changed the name back to Bragg, which celebrates a Confederate soldier who fought for Democratic Party principles in the War of Northern Aggression from 1860 to 1865. Military bases are very lightly protected. They have a number of ingress, egress, infiltration, exfiltration points along the entire periphery where fences can either be non-existent or rather easy to overcome, along with very lightly armed personnel on the base defending it because you aren't allowed to carry firearms on a base. As a soldier, you are prohibited from having a firearm on you at work, whether rifle or pistol. If you happen to be going to the range, it's very structured, it's very restricted, and it's very formally run, and that will be the place that you will find weapon systems. So if you think about it from that perspective, a military base is even safer to hit most likely than any federal law enforcement compound where, for the most part, atomistically, let's suppose FBI at Quantico, most everybody will be carrying a pistol. That is not the case on a military base. So the illustration that I just gave you about that hit down in Mexico on the Sinaloa cartel, in 24 to 48 hours after that, there will be teams of malefactors, armed criminals, in this case, Sinaloa cartel members or auxiliaries, who will have a very sophisticated map and template of who lives where in family housing, who belongs to who, and they've been monitoring cell phone and phone communications. They've probably been monitoring internet communications. And if they haven't been doing any of this, they know that since there is so much domestic surveillance in the United States with the NSA, they have probably found a means to get either a backdoor to the NSA templates and architecture of localized communications on phones and internet and things like that in the Fort Bragg area. But they may even have people working on the inside who give them a steady pipeline of information. The point that I'm trying to make here is that their target intelligence packets on Fort Bragg and on the soldiers there will be just as sophisticated as those that followed CAG into their kinetic hits into the Sinaloa cartel. As a result of that, they are going to have a very sophisticated map for their plan of hitting, either killing or wounding, members maybe not directly of CAG, even though the family facilities are not under lock and key, and they would be able to find through the surveillance machinations that they performed prior to this to form their target intelligence packets that they have dusted off and updated. So within 24 to 48 hours, if you want to, we can call it charitably, a week later, the cartels will reciprocate the hit on themselves in Mexico by a hit most likely at Fort Bragg to hit near where the CAG headquarters is. And by the way, Fort Bragg is the home to the 82nd Airborne Division. It is the home to a variety of special operations organizations to include CAG, to include the flagpole of the U.S. Army Special Forces Command, and other organizations that just so happen to be in support of both black and vanilla special operations forces organizations. It is a huge base. And if they don't happen to hit CAG or CAG family members, and just so happen to hit family members that they have measured for impact and narrative shaping, maybe it would be hitting the flag officers row that would be there, which is where all the flag officers and general officers would be quartered with their families. maybe they would hit there. Maybe they would hit a range at which a unit is participating in training. Maybe they would go to the airfield at Pope and take down aircraft, those very aircraft that are always at the ready to take the brigade minus of 82nd Airborne folks in their 911 mission within 24 to 48 hours anywhere around the world, and hit those aircraft, hit the hangars, hit folks at a PT formation. This is going to happen. Then, of course, the response to this kind of domestic hit of an American military complex is going to lead to an absolutely frenzied uproar of policy machinations and responses to this, and headlines in the United States newspapers that show, for the first time since World War II, when Japanese balloons were aloft over the Oregon coast, or Japanese submarines shot rounds into port facilities in the LA area in World War II, or the U-boat machinations off the coast, the East Coast in World War I, where they actually lobbed shells against both ships and facilities in the air. For the first time, America is under a military attack. Now, mind you, yes, I'm aware of 911. I am aware of what happened then. One could characterize it as a military attack. I think that this one would be characterized as a much more potent and outright military attack if this were to happen. So here's my proposition. By taking the kinetic war to the cartels, which is taking the kinetic war to Mexico, because the Mexican government and the cartels are married to each other, you will get responses. As I have often said, Newton's third law is a stone-cold motherfucker, and America will feel that wrath. As a matter of fact, the wrath could get worse, as I have talked about in my Storming America series in episodes 37, 41 through 43, and 49 through 50, where I talk about that upscaled and upgunned Gaza-style attack on the United States proper. Maybe this could be like an Armageddon button for the cartels, because remember, it was the cartels that have most likely brought in 90% of any Islamist cells that the Islamist malefactors did not want on the above-ground radar living in America. So there are all kinds of things that are going to occur as a result of this. So if you take anything from what I'm telling you today, I think that America needs to practice caution when it comes to, as it recently did, labeling 8 cartels as terrorist factions, putting them on the terrorist list for the United States, and taking the full bevy, bandwidth, and dashboard of American capabilities to include a host of military capabilities and launching those against the cartels. I would suggest that that is not going to end in the meritorious way that American policymakers think that it will. They need to think again, and they need to take a knee and reconsider. So I look forward to the conversations and the emails and the discussions that I get on my Substack. You will find my Substack and email address in the show notes for this podcast on your favorite podcast vendor. I would urge you all to leave stars if you enjoyed this, or to, if you're kind enough to leave a review, I will be forever indebted to you. Same thing applies to Substack. I'd love to have you as a subscriber so that you never miss an episode of either Chasing Ghosts or War Notes. So thank you for listening. You can reach me on email, cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. And I take a chainsaw 3 to 5 times a week against the insipid and incompetent defense establishment at the Libertarian Institute on the blog there, at which I am the Smedley D. Butler Fellow. So again, thanks for listening. Pass on to friends, family, and colleagues if you think they may be interested in listening to this podcast. And again, thank you. This is Bill out.